You know what one of the worst things that's happening right now? It's the loss of actual science. We've been treated to terrible science by our health authorities, and I want to unpack that today for you. Come on, everybody who enjoys science, let's go. All right, welcome to episode 003 here. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson with you today. It is May 21st for me when I'm recording this, 2021. And we're going to be talking about science today, or I guess the misapplication of science. We have been abused by our health authorities, giving us what I consider to be really obviously terrible science, but they call it science. And I've had so many people tell me, oh, but Chris, I'm just following the science. And the answer is no, you're not. So let's go into some of that. But let's get some definitions, because I like to make sure we're all talking about the same thing at the same time. So over here, I pulled this right off of the NCBI, which the NIH, so this comes right off of there, and scientific principles and research practices. Look at that, in highlight, I like this part. Among the very basic principles that guide scientists, as well as many other scholars, are those expressed as respect for the integrity of knowledge, collegiality, honesty, objectivity, and openness. That's it. Knowledge, collegiality, honesty, objectivity, and openness. I like that. I like that a lot. That's what we're trying to do here at Peak Prosperity. Not trying. That's what we are doing. I'm going to model that for you. We're going to talk about how we've been led astray and how the so-called guardians of science have been anything but knowledgeable, collegial, honest, objective, or open. So let's start right here with this most recently. Again, I don't do partisan politics. This isn't a left-right thing. I don't actually care who's sitting next in this seat. I do care, however, about how Anthony Fauci responds to a particular question that I thought was very direct. So we're going to go to that right now. Let's take a quick peek at this. Let's listen in.
Dr. Fauci, do you still support funding of the NIH funding of the lab in Wuhan?
Senator Paul, with all due respect, you are entirely and completely incorrect.
entirely and completely. Hold on here. Dr. Rand Paul asked about, is he a doctor? I think he is. Or was that just his dad? I forget. Anyway, the senator asked Dr. Fauci about the funding of the Wuhan Virology Institute. In fact, it's a well-established fact that through the EcoHealth Alliance and Peter Daszak, there was grants that were conducted and administered by the NIH, which Fauci oversees through the NIAID, that actually had money going to the Wuhan Virology Institute of Virology. So that's actually a fact. So let's listen to how he answers
that
this.
The NIH has not ever and does not now fund gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute.
Do they fund?
Okay, so we're having another trouble here where I'm not exactly clear. This feels like a very measured bureaucratic statement. remember Bill Clinton, and he went, he wanted to parse the meaning of is, right? So there's a very, very, very technical definition under which gain-of-function research, which we should probably define here. Gain-of-function means you mess around with a virus in a way that allows it to gain function, meaning it's going to be more transmissive, more lethal to humans, right? That's what gain of function is. It's kind of a funky, gain of function sounds awesome, but it's not. Gain of function research is about making viruses worse for humans and all of that. So Fauci is saying here unequivocally, the NIH has not, will not, has never funded gain of function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Dr. Barrick,
we do not fund.
Do you fund Dr. Barrick's gain of function research?
Dr. Barrick does not doing gain of function research, and if it is, it's according to the guidelines, and it is being conducted in North.
Dr. Barrick does not do gain of function research, but if he is, that's weasel wording right there. He does not do gain of function research, but if he is, it's according to our guidelines. You know, Ted Bundy never murdered any women, but if he did, it's just ridiculous.
Carolina,
let's keep going here.
You don't think inserting a bat virus spike protein that he got from the Wuhan Institute into the SARS virus is gain of function?
That is
you would
not
be in the minority, because at least 200 scientists have signed a statement from the Cambridge Working Group saying that it is gain of function.
Well, it is not. And if you look at the grant and you look at the progress reports, it is not gain of function, despite the fact that people tweet that.
So do you still support it?
Despite the fact that people tweet that. Listen, all we need then, I guess, is a definition. We're getting real legal here. What is gain of function? So I'm going to get to that in just a minute, but just hold on to this. Notice that Fauci, who's being set up, really the media gives him a huge pass. They've sort of anointed him Pope Fauci. You know, he's infallible. Whatever he says must be true. He's really declarative. The NIH has not and never did fund gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Virology Institute of Virology. That's actually false, and I'm going to show you that it's false. But look at how declarative Fauci is around all of these things. And if he's wrong about this, and this is just a simple matter of science, we don't have to parse definitions too much, what else is he wrong about? That's what we need to know about here.
Money to the Wuhan Virology Institute.
We do not send money now to the Wuhan Virology.
Not now. That's, again, weasel wording. We do not now, he said, but in fact, they have sent money to the Wuhan Virology Institute. Actually, it's happening.
Sending money. We did, under your tutelage. We were sending it through EcoHealth. It was a sub-agency and a sub-grant. Do you support that the money from NIH that was going to the Wuhan Institute?
Let me explain to you why that was done. The SARS.
Okay, so we just admitted that was done. Okay, why that was done. So that's progress. It's true, because it's just a matter of public record. It's all public, been public record since I first reported on this. Back, I think my first report on this was May 4th, 2020. We talked about this very grant, this very
SARS
issue.
SARS-CoV-1 originated in bats in China. It would have been irresponsible of us if we did not investigate the bat viruses and the serology to see who might have been infected.
No, that's cool. If you're just going to do a little surveillance, you're going to go and look at the serology, meaning the serum of people. What they're doing is looking for who might have been exposed to SARS-CoV-1, assuming that had a natural origin and it came from some natural reservoir. Sure, go out and do some. That's fine. That's called surveillance. You're just looking for people's blood markers to say, hey, this is possibly where this virus came from. Because one of the most important things you ever need to know in an outbreak, especially in a pandemic, is where did that come from? What's the reservoir? Who's patient zero in this story? Where is this thing coming from? Because if it's sitting in bats or pangolins or snakes or a lab, you kind of need to know that, because that's the only way you possibly could know how to set up your future surveillance so that you can prevent a pandemic from happening again. I get that. So the argument here is that all that happened with the sending of this money over to the Wuhan Institute of Virology through a grant that went to Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance is that that money went to for surveillance, looking for the serology. That's what he's talking
Perhaps
about.
Perhaps it would be responsible to send it to the Chinese government that we may not be able to trust with this knowledge and with this incredibly dangerous viruses. Government scientists like yourself who favor gain-of-function research.
I don't favor gain-of-function research in China. You are saying things that are not correct.
Let's do a little fact-checking on that. Why don't we just take a quick peek on this? First up, we have this biosafety expert explains why Fauci's NIH gain-of-function testimony was demonstrably false. So this is, I'm getting my drawing too loud here. Dr. Roger Ebright, I've talked with and about him before. Great guy. And he's very much into, he's a scientist. He believes in science, that you should just be accurate and repeatable and all that stuff. Professor of chemistry, chemical biology at Rutgers University, biosafety expert, is contesting NIH Director Anthony Fauci's testimony before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. That's a lot of things all at once. We're going to discuss health, maybe education, maybe labor, possibly pensions. Big committee, I guess. Dr. Fauci's claim made during an exchange with Senator Rand Paul that the NIH has not ever and does not now fund gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology is demonstrably false. At least some of the NIH-funded research conducted at the WIV unequivocally qualifies as gain-of-function. That's what Ebright has said here. Carrying on here, Ebright insists that the research can be classified as gain of function under a number of different definitions, including those found in two pieces of Department of Health and Human Services guidance on the subject. That sounds authoritative enough here, I guess. The first details the Obama administration's 2004 decision to halt domestic gain-of-function research, which it defines as that which, quote, may be reasonably anticipated to confer attributes to influenza, MERS, or SARS viruses, such that the virus would have enhanced pathogenicity and/or transmissibility in mammals, probably including especially humans, but mammals, via the respiratory route. But look at that, mammals. So anything that confers or reasonably is anticipated to confer attributes to either influenza, MERS, or SARS, which are both coronaviruses, such that any of these viruses would have enhanced pathogenicity and/or transmissibility, either more deadly or more easy to catch, right? In mammals via the respiratory route. Okay. The second draft in 2017, as Fauci was pushing to renew government funding for gain-of-function research, and that's what Fauci was doing, provides a definition of what are called enhanced potential pandemic pathogens, PPPs, or those pathogens resulting from the enhancement of the transmissibility and or virulence of a pathogen. Now, this is stuff that Fauci knows all about, right? He's obviously been up to his eyeballs in this all the way along. So for him to say that absolutely there was no gain-of-function research going on, the WIV, none was going on. Well, but he knows that, I mean, listen, I showed you the grant a year ago that I found around the money that the NIH gave to Peter Daszak. And Peter Daszak then gave some of that money, a little over $600,000, went straight to the Wuhan Virology Institute to do all kinds of things. What kind of things? Well, let's take a look. Let's look at this grant one more time. A lot of words appear. I'll let you read them as much as you want. Look at this. Among the many things that they were doing with this money that the NIH gave was creating three test predictions of coronavirus interspecies transmission. So that would be, I guess, between bats and pangolins and humans and mice and civets and things like that. Interspecies transmission, predictive models of host range, that is emerging potential. Okay, that's great. So it's where these hosts hanging out. Tested experimentally using reverse genetics, pseudovirus and receptor binding assays, and virus infection experiments across a range of cell cultures from different species and, money shot time here, humanized mice. That's what they were doing here with this grant. They were taking, they were running genetics. They were taking different pieces of coronaviruses. They were splicing them back together, and they were running them both in human cell lines and in humanized mice. Those are exactly how you go about creating, or arguably having the possibility of creating here. Remember, we said, which may reasonably anticipated to confer attributes. Well, if you want to confer the attribute of the viruses having enhanced pathogenicity or transmissibility, you run them in human cell cultures and you run them in humanized mouse models. And by that, I mean, what they do is they took mice specifically and they knocked out the gene that was for mouse ACE2 and they replaced that with a human ACE2 receptor gene. So now you have a little animal that has a human ACE2 receptor, and they're running coronaviruses up against that. All sorts of different ones. So that is very much the definition of gain of function. Fauci is up here in this thing saying, nah, that wasn't, we're not doing any of that. And it's like, yeah, but you are, and we're not idiots, right? We're capable of reading that and understanding that if you are running humanized mice and you are genetically splicing these little virus bits together, you're conducting gain-of-function research. Full stop. Don't need to be a lawyer. Don't need to be Pope Fauci to figure that one out. But that's where we are in this story right now. So at any rate, let's look at this because, you know, when I first posted this in May of 2004, I think it was May 4th, 2020, sorry, got a lot of flack from that. Had a lot of prominent virologists say that I was engaging in conspiracy theories, that there was absolutely no doubt that this came from a natural origin. This virus couldn't have come from a lab. And I was like, how can you guys say that? Because that's not science. Remember, science is about skepticism, openness, communication, all that stuff. That's what I was worried about at the time was I could clearly see that if coronaviruses in Wuhan were being manipulated to create these different chimeras, meaning chimera meaning two parts, right? Different parts of different viruses, stapling them together, and then running those through cell lines and mouse models, then that's a very, you can't rule out that this thing came from a lab. You can't do that. Maybe you could say, I think it's 99% you know, likely that it came from a natural origin, but you can't rule it out. You just can't. And so now, look at this. We're seeing a lot of this stuff now. This came out on May 2nd. Origin of COVID following the clues. Did people or nature open Pandora's box at Wuhan? This article is asking this question. The COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted the lives world over for more than a year. Its death toll will soon reach 3 million people, yet the origin of pandemic remains uncertain. The political agendas of governments and scientists have generated thick clouds of obfuscation, which the mainstream press seems helpless to dispel. Yeah, you know why Nicholas Wade writes helpless to dispel? Because he is a science writer. He's worked on the staff of Nature and Science, two leading prominent journals, and the New York Times. Thanks, Nick. Nick, great article, actually, by the way. Nicholas, I'm going to give you high props for this. Good, good article. Really well done. But not that last part, which is the mainstream press seems helpless to dispel. In fact, the mainstream press has been doing everything it can to help propel a very narrow agenda, which is the idea that this was only and could only have come from natural origin. But now it's reaching sort of a crescendo. Now we're seeing, you know, all sorts of articles just showing up about the lab leak theory. It's going a little bit more mainstream. That's all wonderful because, you know, why is it wonderful? Because we need to know. We need to know where this came from. It's a really important question, is it not? Did this thing erupt out of nature? If so, let's figure that out, and then let's put up the appropriate surveillance, which you would want to do. Like, let's not have that happen again, right? But if it came from a lab, we need to know that. Not least of which is we should have a big, fat, raging discussion about why maybe we shouldn't be doing gain-of-function research. If it turns out you can't, you know, reasonably prevent accidents, assuming this was an accident, and that's a generous assumption, I guess, but let me go with that. I want to believe it was an accident if it was. Okay, if it was an accident, then we need to know that. And if it wasn't an accident, we need to know that. But until we know those things, we can't have the proper conversation, which is maybe we humans ought to have a little more humility and we really shouldn't be messing around with gain of function. If it turns out we can't put in appropriate biosafety level protocols that will prevent an accident from happening. And by the way, there have been bunches of lab leaks that have happened before accidentally. And it just happens because guess what? Microbes are going to microbe. Viruses are going to virus. They're really hard to keep contained. So at any rate, let's keep going here. So December 2019, really, really important interview. I'm just going to take one little piece. This is an interview that was posted, recorded and posted in December of 2019. Now, remember, this is before and the world knows at all about the fact that there may have been some sort of an event in Wuhan. And this is between the gentleman who runs, this gentleman here on the left, who runs something called This Week in Virology, TWIV, T-W-I-V. And that's Peter Daszak on the right. And he is the person who was running that the humanized models and funneling money over to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Let's listen to what this conversation, very instructive, what was being said back in December of 2019. Now, remember, Anthony Fauci knows this. He knows all about this. He knows about the grants. He knows about all that. And he says, declaratively, there is no gain of function research happening. None. Let's listen in.
But if you're saying these are diverse coronaviruses and you can't vaccinate against them, there are no antivirals, what do we do?
Well, so I think that coronaviruses are pretty good. I mean, you're a virologist, you know all this stuff, but you can manipulate them in the lab pretty easily.
You can manipulate them in the lab pretty easily, step one.
Spike protein drives a lot of what happens with the coronavirus, zoonotic risk. So you can get the sequence, you can build the protein, and we work with Ralph Barrick at UNC to do this.
Ralph Barrick.
Insert it into the backbone of another virus,
right,
and do some work in the lab. See,
full admission right there. What they can do is take the spike protein itself, structure it, insert it into the backbone of another virus, and do some work in the lab. I don't know, like run it through cell lines, run it through mouse models, do all of that stuff, right? Okay, so there is a full admission right there on tape that this gentleman, Peter Daszak, has been fiddling around with coronaviruses in the lab at the Wuhan Institute of Virology and has been doing that right up to in the moments before we had the outbreak start worldwide. So I think it's a reasonable supposition for anybody, any investigative journalist, any journal, any normal human to say, I think this guy's up to his eyeballs in this story, right? You know, and one of my favorite quotes, I say it all the time, is you show me the incentive, I will show you the outcome. This is by Charlie Munger, a Charlie Munger quote. Charlie, of course, being the right-hand man of Warren Buffett. I love this quote because incentives, as long as you know the incentive structure, you know a lot of things. And of course, investigators know this. You know, police detective, if they're investigating a domestic violence case and one of the two people in that household has a black eye and the other one has a busted up set of knuckles, they're probably going to separate them and probably discount the story of the person with the knuckles, just busted knuckles, just a little tiny bit. You know what I'm saying? Like they understand that that person might have an incentive to not maybe be totally truthful in this story. All right. So I want to go to a really monumentally embarrassing thing, which continues, and it's still up. And this is in The Lancet. Now, remember, The Lancet is the premier, preeminent British journal of all things medicine that has just been horrible through this whole coronavirus experience, blocking research and refusing to publish things that had shown, I think, very promising ways of managing COVID, and then promoting other stuff that turned out to be completely false. Remember the Surgisphere thing where they had totally falsified data and The Lancet ran it and didn't even retract it. They waited for the authors to retract it on their own, the two that, anyway, they didn't seem to learn from all that. But this is still up on their website. And this, first up, we have to notice something. This came out in February 19th of 2020. So this is early in the pandemic. It had only been like 5 days earlier that the WHO had even come forward and named this thing as COVID-19, right? So this is really early on. Ostensibly, the world doesn't know a lot about what's going on here yet. And this thing reads, statement in support of the scientists, public health professionals, and medical professionals of China combating COVID-19. So this is a statement in support of certain individuals in China, scientists, public health professionals, medical professionals. So why would Chinese scientists, health professionals, and medical professionals, what kind of support would they need way back in February of 2020, before the world had even cottoned on to this? Remember, February, we were still reading articles in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, all of the rest. They're saying, it's just the flu, bro. Remember that? They're like, oh, this is no worse than the flu. That's where we were. So what kind of statement needs to be made in support here of the scientists and people, medical professionals in China? What kind of statement? So this statement right here. Oh, by the way, let me point out a couple other things. A lot of names on here, right? There's a lot of names. These are all the scientists who said that they're going to sign their names to this particular thing. But we have to just look at one name in here in particular. And let me see, where is it? It's Peter Daszak right here. Peter Daszak, right? That's, of course, this gentleman here who's talking about, hey, we monkey around with these things, coronaviruses. Yeah, we just, you know, we just chimerize them, take chunks of the spike protein, and we do things to them in the lab. And now, 5 days after COVID-19 gets named by the WHO as COVID-19, he comes out and signs this letter here with a bunch of others, 20 total names on there. And here's the statement. It says, we sign this statement in solidarity with all scientists and health professionals in China. So again, Chinese people need a lot of support from these folks, I guess, who continue to save lives and protect global health during the challenge of the COVID-19 outbreak. Okay. We're all in this together with our Chinese counterparts in the forefront against this new viral threat. Get this. The rapid, open, and transparent sharing of data on this outbreak is now being threatened by rumors and misinformation around its origins. We stand together to strongly condemn conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin. Let me just make sure that we understand this. Okay, I lost my... Okay. Says right here, we stand together. Conspiracy theories. So they've already decided that anything that suggests this does not have a natural origin, which means suggesting it does have a lab origin, is a conspiracy theory. They've thrown it down and they've declared that. Now, That's a pretty strong statement. Like, to do that, you have to be 100% sure that this has a natural origin. Of course, the only way you can do that is if you have patient zero and the host itself, and you've identified the exact sequence of SARS-CoV-2 in a natural reservoir. Had that been done by that point in time? No, still hasn't been done. They haven't found any natural reservoir. In fact, it's kind of weird. This thing has the backbone of a bat virus, but it seems to have the receptor binding domain from the spike protein of a pangolin. Looks like kind of like a chimera. It's kind of weird. But look at this. This group was standing together. They say, we stand together to strongly condemn conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin. And of course, there are editors at this place called The Lancet who should have gone back when they said, cool letter, dudes and dudettes. Tell us about your ability to make such a declarative statement. Show us the data that you have. That's how letters like this ought to be vetted. No such thing happened, as far as I know, because they printed it, right? And so they say, they're carrying on, they say, scientists, very, very declarative here, from multiple countries have published and analyzed genomes of the causative agent, severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2 or SARS-CoV-2, and they overwhelmingly conclude that this coronavirus originated in wildlife. References 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Look at all those references. It's so authoritative, right? And so that's it. Scientists from multiple countries of all, we're all in agreement. Had to have come from a natural origin, right? But remember, you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. I would think this guy would be pretty incentivized to want this to come from a natural origin. I'm not, and listen, you know, that, fine, Peter, go out and show us that that's the case. I understand your motivation for very much wanting this not to have come from a lab where, you know, you were doing some stuff in that lab around that looked like and smelled like gain of function stuff, right? So at any rate, let me see, where am I here? So at any rate, this letter, well, here's a fun thing that just came out a little while ago, which was that U.S. Right to Know actually ran a FOIA request and dug up some emails and things and discovered that emails obtained by the U.S. Right to Know show that a statement in The Lancet authored by 27 prominent public health scientists condemning conspiracy theories against suggesting COVID-19 does not have a natural origin was originated by employees of EcoHealth Alliance, a nonprofit group that has received millions of dollars in U.S. taxpayer funding to genetically manipulate coronaviruses with scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The emails obtained via public health records requests show that EcoHealth Alliance President Peter Daszak drafted The Lancet statement and that he intended it to, quote, not be identifiable as coming from any one organization or person, meaning me and my organization, right? But rather to be seen as simply a letter from leading scientists. And Daszak wrote that he wanted to avoid the appearance of a political statement. If you want to, Peter, just a quick pro tip here. If you want to avoid the appearance of a political statement, then you shouldn't throw down in solidarity with the people of China saying that any suggestion that maybe this didn't have a natural origin would somehow be bad for China. That's a little political. I think that's just tiny bit political, but that's me. All right. At any rate, so you know what, though? You heard Peter talk about in that little clip, you mentioned the name Ralph Baric. And Ralph Baric is a leading virologist operating under the UNC at Chapel Hill. And Ralph Baric obviously does gain-of-function research, even according to the testimony of Fauci. Interestingly, in science, very recently we have a letter to investigate the origins of COVID-19. And in there includes this name, Ralph Baric. So Ralph is throwing down saying, hey, we should really investigate the origin of this thing a little bit more. A lot of scientists now are weighing in. I think over 200 total signed this, but you can see here, you read down, these are very prominent people all down this list right here, coming from all sorts of different very prominent places. So they're saying, hey, we should really look into where this thing came from, because there's open question. Now it's okay. Now it's okay for whatever reason to say, where did this thing come from? Maybe we should know. And so reading from this science letter, it says in May 2020, the World Health Assembly requested that the World Health Organization Director General work closely with partners to determine the origins of SARS-CoV-2. Yeah, they should. The WHO was supposed to go over to China and find out where this thing come from, you know, and they're working with partners to do that. What kind of partners? At any rate, although where'd it go? Lost my thing. Oh, yeah, here it is. Says, although there were no findings in clear support of either a natural spillover or a lab accident, the team assessed a zoonotic spillover from an intermediate host as likely to very likely, and a laboratory incident as extremely unlikely. So the WHO assembles a team, sends them over. That's what they conclude. Very unlikely, extremely unlikely. This came from a lab. Furthermore, the two theories were not given balanced consideration. Only 4 of the 313 pages of the final report and its annexes addressed the possibility of a laboratory accident. Only 4 of the 313 pages. So you can kind of see they kind of gave it a little short shrift. They didn't really look into it too hard. They just didn't do that too much. Again, you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. So in its infinite wisdom, we would have to ask, who did the WHO, who did they put in there? We'll look at that in just a second. Let me see. They say here, we must take hypotheses about both natural and laboratory spillover seriously until we have sufficient data. A proper investigation should be transparent, objective, data-driven, inclusive of broad expertise, subject to independent oversight, and research laboratories alike need to open their records to the public and be responsibly managed to minimize the impact of conflicts of interest. A proper investigation should be transparent, objective, data-driven, inclusive of broad expertise, subject to independent oversight, and responsibly managed to minimize the impact or the appearance of conflicts of interest. What conflicts of interest could there be? I think we were just talking about some of those. You know, conflicts of interest might be, hey, I'm on record saying we're dabbling, doing chimerized, humanized mouse experiments with this thing that just erupted and sort of destroyed the world. And you might imagine reasonably that person who might have a conflict of interest, and that would not be somebody you would want sort of at the forefront of that investigation. Remember my thing about the knuckles and the domestic abuse? So on that end, though, the WHO did assemble a team. And you want to know who's the head of that team, who's leading that delegation to China, who led that and authored the report? You want to know? Any guesses? That's right, Peter Daszak. Obvious natural choice for somebody that you'd want to put at the head of the crew to go and ask the question of China, your partners, who you've just defended in a research letter way back in February of 2020. You'd want that person to be investigating the natural versus lab origin theories. So that's again, where I lose faith in these institutions and organizations. But it was pretty comprehensive. Remember I said there were all these leading virologists way back at the time who said declaratively, way back, not a chance this thing is anything other than a natural origin. This was Michael Ulsterholm on Joe Rogan saying here, man-made diseases, that's exactly, we scientists could not have crafted a virus like this to do what it's doing. I mean, we don't have the creative imagination or skill set. Actually, we do. It's very well known that we do, we have the capability of creating these viruses from soup to nuts, start to scratch. You can do it either with signatures that will show that it was created in a lab, or you can do it without those signatures. Totally known, and I've got all the data and all the statements by leading virologists to prove that's true. It's just the case. But this is Michael Ulsterholm. He's not nobody. He's an American epidemiologist. He's Regents Professor, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Very powerful position. And on November 9th, he was named a member of President-elect Joe Biden's COVID-19 advisory board. And here he is on record saying there's not a chance that this thing came from a lab, must come from nature. And so this was just sort of the environment we were dealing with about a year ago. And now it's softening up. Now people are starting to ask that question. So at any rate, way back a year ago, it was completely obvious to me that you couldn't definitively rule in or out either the lab theory or the natural theory. You just couldn't. Scientifically speaking, you couldn't. But we had prominent scientists like this guy saying all the time that you could rule it in or out. You can say definitively, based on what we know about this virus, there's no way we could have created it. It's a little bit weasel wording. I know what he was getting at there. It's like, we humans couldn't punch this into a set of things we wanted this virus to do into a computer and have it predict an algorithm for what the basis should look like in the RNA sequence. True. But what you can do is you can take known operative spike proteins, known backbones, chimerize them, staple them together, and put them through humanized mouse lines and other cell lines, and you can actually let nature or big giant combinatorial mathematics of a viral replication do the work for you. That's what they do. You just let nature do it. And so then we don't have to be smart enough to figure out a virus like this. We let nature figure it out. You know, trillions and quadrillions of copies of viruses are passed and created each time you push it through a mouse model and or a cell line in a cell culture. And then over time, you select for the characteristics you want and nature creates it. So I know what he was going at here, but it was very disingenuous at best to go through that. All right. Another place, there's just so many areas here. This episode is about science and about, I just love science. I mean, can't we just have logic and reason? Can't we have 1 + 1 = 2 all the time? Now, in the prior episode, episode 2, I talked about how we all of a sudden had the director of the CDC coming forward and talking about the distinction of died of COVID versus died with COVID. I need to talk about that again. And, oh, by the way, quick correction. I made a mistake in that where I said that there was the AstraZeneca jab was just one. I was talking about Eric Clapton's experience. In fact, many of you pointed out, in fact, that's a 2-shot series. So I just want to correct that publicly here. But let's look now at this weekly excess deaths from the CDC. I mean, the story right now is that 570,000 Americans have died. And so, hey, Liv, let's go full frame on this for a while. Cool. Thanks. So what we're looking at here is total deaths in the United States on a weekly basis. This is a scale over here that goes, you know, from 40,000, 50,000, 60,000. So on average, it looks like the United States average is like 50, 60, 70,000 deaths per week. And you see, it's got that sort of, these look like waves coming across the top of this thing. And so there's a seasonality to all of this. This top line here, this solid sort of orangey line here, that's the, what if you pierce that line with observed deaths, you've exceeded what they call their baseline for excess deaths. So if you get above that, they're going to say, wow, we have some excess deaths. We see some appearing back here in 2019 and 18 around flu season. So anytime you get these little death bars poking their head, they're little blue bars above that orangey line, you get those little red plus signs there and says, yeah, we had excess deaths. Now, we see back here COVID clearly poking its head above this line, and they're saying everything we're going to count above this line, we're going to call all of those excess deaths from COVID. Now, normally I wouldn't really have a problem with that, but I want to make sure that we're counting apples with oranges. So let me show you something on this chart where I go, what is going on here? The first thing is I've put a solid dotted line on the peaks. This is the peaks of this rhythmic death count. You see these peaks of the expected deaths goes up, goes up, goes up. What you see here in charting terms would be called a series of higher highs. This high point is lower than this high point, which is higher. Okay. And then this point is higher. And we would expect that to see a series of higher highs in this data. Why? Well, because the population of the United States is growing and demographically it's aging. So it kind of makes sense that each succeeding year you would expect to see more deaths. And we see that in 2018 and 19 and early into 2020, but then 17, 18, 19. But then we get to 2020. Mysteriously, I want you to notice here that they said their expected death count here is, look at this here. See, it's less right there where that yellow piece is right there. Look at that. The line is way under what we would have expected to see. If we had a series of higher highs, we would have expected this orange line to be way up here somewhere, right up around there. Similarly, look at the higher lows. So this is a low here, here's a higher low, here's a higher low. And so we would have expected this line here to be way up around there. So what's happening here? How is it that the CDC expected that there would be fewer deaths in 2020? Now, why is that important? Well, because what they're saying are excess deaths are excess above expected deaths. If your expected deaths If you ramp that line down, if you push your expected death line down, naturally your excess death count goes up higher. So I don't have any good explanation for this. I haven't been able to find any good explanation for why the CDC would have expected both the highs and the lows of the 2020 deaths to have been less than you would have expected from just drawing simple trend lines where you see higher highs and higher lows. So let me see if I can correct that a little bit, and we'll get into that. So, I'm going to zoom in on this. Here's another way to look at this. What we're looking at here is just a chart where we're seeing the upper bound. So this is expected deaths again in this solid orange line. And then anything in green is sort of what they would have expected deaths to be. And blue, they're calling those COVID deaths. You add all those little blue lines up there, you come up with 500 and some odd thousand deaths. All right. But again, we can notice here that problem of where are the higher highs and higher lows. And if we just filled in the expectation of what we would have seen, I drew in this, see this little green line right here? I drew this in here, starting there. And I drew it in and it's got a peak about here. And I made a higher low as well. And they touch these lines, these solid lines I drew in. That means that all of these deaths that have been recorded as part of COVID under here, these don't belong in here, according to this method. And again, look, there might be perfectly good reasons for this, but there's no transparency, there's no explanation around this. This is just science. So if you're going to, as the CDC, change your methodology for why you would expect fewer deaths in 2020, then I think what you really got to do is you got to explain that and you've got to tell people why that is. But they don't. They just nudged the expected death line down, had more unexpected deaths as a consequence, reported all of those as COVID, and here we are. Why is this important? Because epidemiologically, you need to know. You need the base data. You have to understand what the true state of deaths were, who was dying, why were they dying. We can parse through that data again, understand, you know, serologically, did these people have less vitamin D in their systems? What was the role of zinc, selenium, any of these other things? Like, to really understand what we were facing from a pandemic, you got to have accurate data. So this is where it all starts. I'm not saying there weren't excess deaths from COVID. I'm just saying I'm disputing the way they were recorded and cataloged because they changed the methodology on these halfway through the process. All right. So I can make a prediction off of this. I have a hypothesis. I got a deduction from that and then a prediction. First, the hypothesis here is that many infirm people who were close to the end of their lives had their deaths hastened by COVID. So we know all these people had comorbidities. They were elderly. They were in nursing homes. They already had several things wrong with them. COVID comes along as just one too many straws on the camel's back, and these people died. The deduction you can take from that idea is that those people who have already died, those people have already died, all the people with all those comorbidities who are already elderly, and therefore they won't be contributing to future death counts. And so the prediction is that future death counts will actually be reduced because of COVID. So this helps us to frame. So if somebody died from COVID who otherwise wouldn't have died, had a very long life in front of them, that's still tragic, but it's a different form of a tragedy than a very young person who has a lot of life ahead of them dying from COVID, not with, I guess what we're looking at here. So that's the prediction set. Oh, hey, interesting headline just came out the other day. They said death rate in England is the lowest since records began. Just 851.2 people per 100,000 died last month. Lowest figure since the ONS started recording mortality rates in 2001. We're going to see more headlines like this. That's the prediction. Could be wrong, but this is how science works. I have a hypothesis. We have a deduction from that, and therefore we can make a prediction. So I think we're going to see more and more of this as we go on. But my faith in things took a little bit of a hit when I looked at these numbers and I found out that inexplicably, the expected death line had been lowered considerably from what I would have expected just based on simple trend extrapolation, which is if those two lines are headed up, the higher highs and the higher lows, why wouldn't you just continue that as an expectation? And I would. Demographically, that's what I would have expected. More old people, larger population. I would have expected more deaths in the future, not fewer. So I'm not clear on that. I hope somebody from the CDC can clear that up for us here. All right. As well, science really took a hit when we looked at the NIH treatment guidelines. So these are the most recent COVID-19 treatment guidelines out there. And vitamin D, last updated April 21st, 2021. The NIH recommendation is there are insufficient data to recommend either for or against the use of vitamin D for the prevention or treatment of COVID-19. In fact, there's a lot of science. I would say more than sufficient data, tons of science out there from really good places, and it's really good work. There's some great work out of Spain on this. There was a really nice epidemiological study out of Israel around this. In fact, this is actually, as far as I'm concerned, settled science. It's really settled. But not to put too fine a point on it, even if you did recommend people take vitamin D, there's no downside to that because it's exceedingly safe. It's not like there's this tiny margin of safety, and if people take too much, bad things happen. It's really easy to get the levels of vitamin D correct. And of course, if anybody's thinking of going on and taking, we would recommend go get the levels baselined at your doctor's office, find out how much you should be taking to get up above those levels, because there's very, very strong science that says this stuff works, but no treatments for you. There's nothing. NIH says there's nothing, nothing there. Zinc, also last updated April 21st, they say, insufficient data include it in the treatment guidelines. They recommend against, however, using zinc supplements above the RDA, the recommended dietary allowance for the prevention of this thing here, except in clinical trial. They gave it a B3 rating. So that's a very, very low rating. It means this is possibly dangerous, expert opinion only, totally no data. Actually, there's tons of data. We've presented it before, lots of data. There was a very strong study that was done that showed both zinc and selenium very highly correlated serum levels with outcomes on this particular disease state. So I would love to hear why they believe, this committee believes, that there is insufficient data, because to me, again, when the safety profile on this thing is so wide, you would have to actually come up with a compelling argument for why not, rather than waiting for super strong, compelling evidence for why to use it. But I consider that the scientific data that we have plenty sufficient to recommend it. As well, here's why I have to be super careful. These are YouTube posting guidelines now. I'll let you read that part in yellow down there because I can't even say these words. We call them Dwizabin, standing for drugs which shall not be named. Dwizabin 1 and 2 are both expressly forbidden at this point in time to talk about, which is kind of weird. And, you know, again, here's NIH. They say there's insufficient data to recommend either for or against the use of Dwizabin 2 here, which I have to call it. And results from adequately powered, well-designed, well-conducted clinical trials are needed to provide more specific evidence-based guidance on the role of Dwizabin 2 in this treatment of this thing. All right. What's kind of weird is that there's super powerful data. This is a great article by Steve Kirsch, just an amazing gentleman. He wrote this. This went in Trial Site News April 24th, 2021. It says, For example, for Dwizabin 2, in the past year, there have been 52 studies, 48 of them published in peer-reviewed journals. Only one of those studies was negative. However, evidence-based medicine is unable to make a conclusion one way or the other as to whether this stuff might work. 51 out of 52 success rate is considered too close to call since there could be a bias or confounder affecting all these independent studies. The fact that nobody has been able to postulate any such confounder or bias that could explain the consistency is immaterial, since it does not prove that there isn't one. That's where we're at. This is why my faith in science is taking a ding. 51 out of 52. That's overwhelming. That's a slam dunk. In science, that's absolutely astonishing. It's really an astonishing finding. All right. And as well, he continues, I believe there's a bias in interpreting these results. Had the Dwizabin 2 studies all had the same outcomes, but in reverse, where 51 of 52 studies showed a negative effect, is there any doubt that the same experts would cite these as definitive proof that the drug does not work and strongly recommend it should not be used, right? Carrying on here, he says, one need look no further than the Dwizabin 1 studies data to prove this interpretation bias. With Dwizabin 1, there have been 29 early treatment studies, 100% positive. And there was just another huge study out of Iran, again, just enormously positive. And the experts have determined that Duizabin should not be used. It's baffling, he writes. That's very kind of Steve to write that. Beautiful piece. You should check that out. Trial Site News. Oh, by the way, notice there's a link down there. I link all of this stuff. I provide all the links to all this stuff, all the CDC data, every piece of it, obviously links, so you can read it for yourself. Tell me what you think. All right. Okay. So as well, I think I have to continue on and talk about, yeah, my good buddy, Dr. Pierre Corey and his wonderful, wonderful team, including Joseph Verone, Paul Merrick, Iglesias, and Umberto. They're just amazing crew. They're astonishingly full of integrity. I got to be honest. If I ever end up in the ICU for sepsis or any other reason, these are the people I want looking after me, hands down, no question about it. So if I'm incapacitated, fly me there, please, to any one of their care centers, because these doctors are the best. And so they wrote this review article. It's got kind of a spotted history because it was supposed to go into a Swiss journal that I don't even want to name. All right. It was in Frontiers. It was supposed to go into Frontiers in Pharmacology. It was accepted, peer-reviewed, accepted, and then editorially was rejected for not meeting their standards by some vague things because an outside unnamed party leveled a charge against it, and they decided that was more serious than the four peer reviewers who actually read it. Got rejected from that. Unheard of to have an already accepted peer-reviewed journal article rejected at the time for editorial reasons, but that happened. Hey, guess what? The paper ended up being published ultimately in American Journal of Therapeutics, and this is review of the emerging evidence demonstrating the efficacy of Duizabin 2 in the prophylaxis and treatment of COVID-19. Great paper, tons of evidence and data in there. How could I even pick any one piece to sort of show, but I picked this one, which is this forest plot chart here, which shows, if we look at it very carefully, this line right here, if you are to the left of this line, then that means the stuff had a very good effect. It was positive. And if the studies showed an effect to the right of this line, that would say it was a negative result and possibly it was harmful. By the way, log scale. So this is 0.1. This is a hazard reduction ratio. 0.1 means there's a 90% reduction in whatever it is you're looking for. And so death, a 90% reduction in death. Does that sound favorable to you? I know I would prefer a 90% reduction over no reduction in death. That's how I would go about it. So at any rate, there is super, super powerful data all over the place. 51 out of 52 studies, all of that. And still, this is what we have here. Insufficient data. We've got insufficient data to recommend either for or against. That's the nature of the beast right now. By the way, this series talking about the No Treatments for You was sponsored by this gentleman down here. Very much thank you for your sponsorship. Appreciate that. For those of you who don't know, that's the soup guy from Seinfeld. Remember? No soup for you, right? So at any rate, no treatments for you. Think about the state of medical nihilism you live in, where known solid science repeatedly 51 out of 52 times says something is valuable, beneficial, and could save your life, if not prevent people from suffering long-term effects. And you live within a system where the medical establishment says, not for you. You don't get that. We don't agree with that. For whatever sets of reasons, I'm not going to speculate about that, but it's anti-science. And every time we have these things, whether it's fudging the numbers, whether it's declaratively saying that this thing couldn't have come from a lab, whether it's saying we don't have enough evidence to provide these treatments for you, this is all a form of abuse of science and the scientific method and principles. And it serves to erode people's confidence and faith in the system, in each other, in the larger system in which we live, and in my case, my sense of hope for the future, because we got some really complicated things we're going to have to get through in the next 10 or 20 years, right? Got climate change, disappearing soils. We might have to retool our entire energy infrastructure. These things are going to be hard, right? Hard. And I'm here to say that this is easy data. This is easy. If we can't do easy, how are we going to do hard, right? Well, that's actually the challenge that we're up against. And because I think it's pretty obvious that we can't do the easy stuff, so we're going to have a hard time with the hard stuff. That's why I keep telling people, you got to plant a garden. There's a whole reason why I think this is the case. If you want to understand why I think you should plant a garden more deeply, I can't, there's obviously Dwizabin 1, Dwizabin 2. There's things I can't say out here in public anymore. So if you like that stuff, you like the data, all that, just come on by Peak Prosperity. We got no censorship going on there. Full-throated conversations. You can learn how we think. This is how I'm teaching, training how I think and how I look at things. You join the tribe. That's awesome. All right. For today, our conclusions are. I'm going to have to, let me just take this so it's not hidden. There we go. Science, it's not being practiced. It's not being practiced right now, followed or promoted by U.S. or even global health authorities. That's a problem. That erodes confidence in all sorts of things. Science is taken on tones of religiosity in the United States. People say they're following the science, but in fact, they're following the unfounded assertions of personalities. We're not following the science at this point in time. You know, Fauci said, I hear that all the time, but Fauci said, like, dude, that guy is, he's not exactly being forthright with a bunch of stuff. And I showed you some of that today. And the costs of not following the science, these are enormous. They're really big. The economy's been damaged. Lives and livelihoods have been diminished and damaged. We have loss of faith in our institutions. We have a diminished sense of togetherness through this whole thing. It's really awful. We should have been following the science. And science is a process. Open inquiry and exploration of the ideas. That's what we really should have been doing. And so that's, to me, the worst part. Trust has been lost in this particular case. And so that's the part I condemn the most, is that the political interests, the economic interests, whatever those interests are of the people who've been doing the prevaricating, the lying, the fibbing, the parsing of overly narrow parsing of like gain of function. No, we don't do that. We just help these viruses get better at infecting mammals. Come on, stop with that stuff already. So that loss of trust, that's what I decry here. I think it's time for the scientific method to come back. It's possible. In the absence of that happening in the national conversation, that's why we're having it here. And so we're going to keep doing that. Increasingly, though, you're going to find that over at my website, Peak Prosperity. Come on by, check it out there. If you want to discuss anything we talked about here today, go on back over to that website, Peak Prosperity, and you'll find us having really awesome conversations in response to the one we had last week. Amazing stuff where people were parsing through the numbers, the data, looking at really, truly, what are the risks, the overall risks of COVID in various age groups, by sex, stratifying, by comorbidities, doing all this incredible stuff that honestly, why are we doing it? Yeah, because nobody else is, right? It's not happening out there amongst our authorities. So that's it. That's all I have for you today. Thank you so much for listening, because we're talking about something I care passionately about, which is logic, open, curious inquiry of the data, wherever that information may lead us. Because that, my friends, is science.